that to become kind of a floating panel is known around the festival as the jazz panel. Originally, there were really two, but the one yesterday afternoon was kind of collapsed into this one. Neither of the panels had very specific topics. One was trends in jazz today, and the other was musicians' lives. I thought perhaps that we could sort of combine those two and maybe also address ourselves in to some of the very broad general questions that have been raised at some of the very good and very interesting panel discussions here about art and the environment, about aesthetics and theology and whether they can be reconciled. Also, there was a topic yesterday, a panel mostly consisting of architects that discussed that one, and that was excellence and commitment. Now, I think that in the music, which for lack of a better term is known as jazz, and somehow or other that seems to be the word that we always come back to, over the years many substitutes have been introduced, but somehow that's a tenacious little four-letter word. It may not be a word with the world's most distinguished pedigree in the sense of its supposed original meanings, but it has gathered enough glory to itself, I think, in the last 100 years or so for us to wear it proudly. In any case, that music, in that music, excellence and commitment, I think, have always been taken for granted, and perhaps too much so, because in no other music that I know is the musician so clearly making a commitment every time he plays. Because when he plays for an audience or for himself, that's him or her out there. He's laying it on the line. It's in that sense a very naked music and therefore also very vulnerable. And as somebody said yesterday, I think Richie Bayrak, ephemeral in nature. And yet, despite of that, it has achieved in a relatively short time some of the greatest artistic creations of our time, indisputably, I think. Anyway, we have a distinguished panel here, and we may be joined by one or two others as we go along. The time for this has been floating. I guess they figured it was a jazz panel, so we should keep it loose and get an improvisatory quality into it.
Close enough.
You can read biographies of most of the distinguished people at this table in your program, and because we only have an hour, I don't think I want to go into lengthy biographical sketches. That would keep us here for a long time. But Dave Liebman and Richie Bayrak are here at Arcosanti for the third time, which speaks for itself. And those of you who were lucky enough to hear them play together last night will know why they're here. They have both they've been friends for a very long time and have played together for a long time, and you can tell. And individually, they have played work together a lot. Individually, David has worked with Miles. Richie has been with Stan Getz, among others. But as, again, if I were to go down the whole trip, their credentials are impeccable. Professor Thomas Ferguson is director of jazz studies at Arizona State University. He is a recent transplant to this state. When I first met him was at the Notre Dame Intercollegiate Jazz Festival many years ago, and he was leading a band from Memphis, which is forever embedded in my memory because at a festival that had some very good bands. That was the only band that was really swinging. And since then, Tom and I have crossed paths a number of times. He is a member of the National Endowment for the Arts Jazz Advisory Panel, and he's also a hell of a piano player. Bernard Purdy, I hope you heard yesterday at the presentation he did with Freddie Waits. Bernard Purdy, to make a a long story short, is the king of soulful drummers and an extraordinary gentleman. I think maybe what we ought to start out with is maybe to talk a little bit about the situation of jazz today. And, well, Richie, why don't you start here?
Well, I was saying yesterday, I think that, if we talk about the 70s, which we're at the end of, has been a period of synthesis, where a lot of the influences of world music, Indian music, and African music, classical music, rock and roll, everything has been kind of synthesized into different combinations. We call this fusion. Some people call it confusion, you know. It's produced some very good music. And it really has strong roots in the past. If you think about the Latin jazz fusion in the 40s and 50s with Dizzy Gillespie and Chano Pazzo, Machito, and Tito Puente, that has very strong roots, and that's a very strong case to make for thinking about fusion in terms of a progress situation rather than a return. Also, fusion of classical music and jazz, which never really, in my opinion, came off, so-called third stream attempt, is happening more now. It's kind of happening in a much more natural way, where there's a give and take between classical musicians and jazz musicians, where sometimes you can't tell who's who, you know? And I think that's a good thing. You have a lot of people approaching, like from the institutions and academies, they approach Cecil Taylor and they ask him for a score, and he says, there's no score, I just played it, you know. So I think that what's happening now is really coming to an end. I think most of the great fusion bands of the 70s are split up and over. There's been a return to acoustic music. People like John McLaughlin and Herbie Hancock's VSOP, a lot of stoned-out electric bands are coming back to playing acoustic music again. I think it's a really good sign. It's healthy. There will always be fusion music. There will always be jazz. It's a question of when they come together. I particularly think that the 80s and 90s, not just in music, but in the general feeling in the world, will be a time for more innovation than the 70s. I haven't seen any real innovations in the sense of Charlie Parker and John Coltrane and great conceptual geniuses appearing on the scene. They might be around, but I haven't seen them, you know.
Thank you, Richard. Tom, you have...
Of course, as in terms of jazz education, quote-unquote, most of our students are in the imitative processes. We're very much interested in what the great players are doing and recording. We're at their mercy, so to speak. I'd be curious, because I do not live in New York, I'd be curious at their feeling of the, has the rise of the commercial fusion thing hurt your cause, so to speak, in the New York areas?
I don't think in New York it has. Is this on?
No.
Okay, I know this is on. The question was whether, from Tata, the commercial fusion thing has hurt our cause. I'm assuming you mean cause of pure jazz, yeah. New York happens to be one of the few places, it seems to me, that can hold all types of music and still keep a very active audience and an active population of musicians involved in that music. So in a sense, that fusion music has been a very popular media event and has created a lot of sales and interest in jazz. I don't think that has hurt the cause in New York, because actually what's occurring in New York, and if you've been there lately and are interested in jazz, I think you would notice very obviously if you look at a paper like the Village Voice any given week and you have 2, 3, 4 pages of clubs besides separate promotional concerts, at least 3 to 5 concerts per weekend, large concerts in large halls. And you have these 2 or 3 pages when really, I remember 5 or 6 years ago, it was a half a page, if I recall. And that shows something right away. And all of these places, for the most part, about 85% of them or something, it's a large percentage, are acoustic jazz. And not just acoustic jazz, but bebop. I mean, guys playing tunes, you know, old tunes, new tunes, all kinds of stuff. But an amazing amount of interest in that. And I think it's basically one important reason for that is because that music has settled into becoming something that you kind of go and live with. You don't necessarily go to special concert of it so much as you might have 10, 15, 20 years ago when it was the newer music. Now you go to a club and you might have dinner and Art Farmer could be playing. And that's not a reflection on Art Farmer or on that music. It just means it's kind of seeped into a place in our lives where it's, at least in a place like New York, where it's really, it's part of what goes on. And I don't think it'll ever be endangered by any trend or lack of trends. It's something, especially in New York. From living on the West Coast, I will say that it's quite different on the West Coast, especially in Los Angeles, of all places, but we needn't get into that.
I would like to elaborate on what he just said about New York, because I am in New York and I live in New York. And in the last 2 years, the music scene has changed drastically. Whereas we now have live music in almost 60% of the clubs in New York City. Now, basically, we have roughly 3,000 clubs in New York City. I happen to know because I work with Local 802. Almost. But we basically have about 3,000 clubs that could hold live entertainment. Now, 2 years ago, it was mostly records because it was cheaper. People didn't go out, and they spent most of their money within their homes buying records. But today we have more and more people going back out again to listen to live entertainment. Not only are they listening to live entertainment, but they're buying records. The buying media for record buying has moved from the age of 15 through 21 for, as they call the rock and roll era, but it has stretched out to where it's called good music from the ages of 15 to 35. And then you have between the ages of 25 and 45, they're going back to buying, as we call it, which will always be here, jazz. But it is commercialized. But it's commercialized to one degree that everybody is getting a chance to understand, feel what the artist is trying to feel, and yet getting it to a point where they can understand it. And that was the hardest problem that we had 20 years ago. Everybody just didn't understand jazz. But now, today, it has been put together to where the commercialism can work on both parts, where it can help the artist and the artist not have to starve to death, and also get across to the people what they want to say without being hurt and without going so far back as to say, hey, man, you ain't doing nothing but a lot of notes. But basically now he's doing good music, which has always been. And if we would use those titles as good music, we'd never have to worry about anything. Jazz would be here for the rest of our lives, and it will be, anyhow. But I really like to say that New York is jumping. Oh, I'm so glad. I'm so glad.
I protest against that last remark.
Sure.
I'd like to introduce Freddie Waits, whom I hope a number of you met yesterday at the percussion demonstration. Again, I don't want to give a long biography, but Mr. Waitz is a phenomenal multi-percussionist and a faculty member at Livingston College, Rutgers University.
Get rid of it.
We're talking about the situation of the music today in general.
Okay. I don't know what's been said, but the situation in New York City, I think Bernard was speaking on, I think there are some very good things happening now. I think catching the end of his conversation, he did say a couple of things that I definitely agree with, was the fact that music is definitely coming back into New York. And to really follow that statement, I don't think it really ever left New York City. It was always happening in New York. It was just the other part of the world. You see, people in New York feel that there's New York, and then after New York, you're in California. All this out here doesn't exist, you know. So I think me personally have been doing a lot of traveling across the country. I found that there are people in every part of this country that has always been very interested in jazz, quote unquote. Calling the world jazz again, we had a conference about two summers ago in Bennington College in Vermont, I was a part of, where it was a total discussion of the fact, should the name be changed from jazz to what? I don't know. There were several different names mentioned and why. But the fact is that the whole meeting resolved to the fact that if we did that, we suffered the consequences of possibly losing people who had really grabbed the hold of the term of jazz as their whole thing and philosophy about the music. So I think it was then resolved that each individual within himself would have to deal with it on his own personal level as to how he felt the music was to him, if it was jazz, if it was creative, whatever, or whatever they want to call it. But yet, in terms of media, the word jazz would still stay out. I mean, there are various reasons, of course, given why we did not want to use the word jazz. And a lot of them made sense, a lot of them didn't. But in the case, we really believe that if we change that name, which could be done, it would take a lot of work, but it could be done. We could actually hurt ourselves because of the fact that people have really grown so attached to the word itself and relating it to certain people and to a whole idea in the music situation. I think that one thing that has helped jazz, the music today, is the fact that people like Bernard, Tom Ferguson, Morgenstern, Liebman, and Virac are now coming out speaking to people as yourselves and telling them the problems and the things that we are actually dealing with on a business level, a social level, and a musical level in our musical careers. We found that people are actually sympathetic to those things and they want to respond to them. It's the fact that they are not aware of the certain things that are happening and why certain things are happening. Once people are informed, they react. And a lot of those reactions have been very positive, I'm happy to say. And myself, young people in the universities and colleges across the country are very responsive to these things. It's just that they are not informed. A lot of the information given to them is false information. People like ourselves have been giving them the route to correct information. Where can you find the right thing? What is actually happening? Who are writing the right reviews? Who are reviewing things as they should be? And I think if you begin to listen to these people, especially the people that I know on this panel are really coming up with wonderful ideas and ways to help you get to the sources of what's happening with the music, I think it'll continue to grow, not only in New York, but the rest of the world, the rest of the country as well.
One of the, obvious things to point to about this place here, Arcosanti, is that it is the city of the future, so to speak. I think for that reason it's very good and very heartening that jazz has been part of the programming here from the start, because it's jazz in a sense is the urban music incarnate. The question of the environment in which the music very often had to grow up, and which in some part is a reason for some of those misconceptions that people have about the word jazz, for instance, about it, its supposed origins in New Orleans, in the red light district, which is nonsense because it was played all over the city, and by no means even played mostly in that particular environment. But it's, you know, last night I was thinking how marvelous it is to be able to hear two fine jazz artists perform in a setting like this, you know, under the sky and in a beautiful place like this. Whereas for so many, many years, the music was very often confined to smoky nightclubs and to other kinds of environments, which were not conducive. It's the amazing thing about this music is that in spite of all this, you know, the people who created it had the tremendous, you know, strength and inner resources to, you know, to do it in spite of all that. Of course, it was also played in ballrooms. There's nothing wrong with ballrooms. They can be a very nice environment. But it's, you know, it's about time that the music was brought out and is being brought out into the open, so to speak, into clear air. And I think maybe some of the panelists might have some ideas about that. Today, can you support yourselves essentially by doing concert work and clinics and so on, but or do you still have to work in clubs? And do you want to keep on working in clubs?
Well, I think, especially on this panel, is a wide assortment of the way musicians make a living. I would venture to say probably no anybody sitting here makes their living solely from one activity of music, would seem to me. So after that, it's a matter of how many you have to keep together, how much money you want to make, and how much you need. But the thing about clubs is that, to me, the ideal situation is in playing in all kinds of environments. In other words, the festival environment, which is what this is, outdoor, especially when we play downstairs, which is a whole other scene. That's one particular way and one effect on the music. Playing in a concert hall like an Avery Fisher or some kind of formal setting is another kind, and then the club is another kind, and then recording is yet another. So all these different situations and a couple of others, clinics are even another situation because you're playing for students. So it's different than playing for a regular audience, entertaining. So all these situations are really good, and I hate to give up the clubs because the thing about the clubs is that's where the musicians really stretch out. It seems, by and large, at least from my experience in listening when I was learning the music, an artist like John Coltrane or Miles Davis, and I think it can be attested to now by the number of releases from live situations, which were not released, at least in Trane's case when he was alive, the kind of intensity and experimentation or whatever you want to call it that's going on only seems to really happen at a consistent level in a club because of the atmosphere, the ambience, the fact that it is loose, and the fact that you really have usually three sets. And that makes quite a thing because playing jazz is, it might appear different to the non-musician, but for a musician, it seems to me it's, you know, it's a very kind of physical act. It's like getting up in the morning and you go through your day. Right? You know, playing is getting on the stage, getting in tune to your instrument for that day, no matter how much you practiced or didn't practice. Getting a feeling for the room, the sound, the other musicians, the particular music of the night. And of course, that all takes a certain amount of time, maybe minutes, maybe hours, maybe years. But it goes on, and usually by about the second or third set, a band is starting to feel loose on a night-to-night basis. And I found in the bands that I've worked with, when they've worked night-to-night, they have made the most advances in the evolution of that band's music by the end of a few weeks of working. So a situation that's ideal, if you're a kind of musician who can call your shots as far as your working situation, is to have some big concerts where you make the brand, you play for a lot of people, but some small clubs where it's a good club, good sound, good equipment, and you can really get close to the other musicians and to the people.
Well, as far as living in New York and, that's right, living in New York and trying to earn a decent living without really doing too much that you don't want to do. I mean, I started playing bar mitzvahs and weddings when I was 14, 15 in the Catskill Mountains in New York, playing for strippers and singers and horror stories and, you know, all male bars, you know, that kind of stuff. And I think that even though I hated it when I did it, I think it was very important. It's kind of like a trial by fire, you know. It's very important to have as much varied experience in music. And you learn some really basic things about projecting, doesn't matter what you're playing, to a hostile audience, to an audience that wants to see the stripper rather than hear you play, competing with people drinking and eating. It's an ordeal, but it makes you strong in a certain way, so that when you do have the opportunity to have a quiet audience in a magnificent setting like this, it's really, first of all, you deserve it, you feel right about it, and you make the most of it, because you don't have to put yourself in a pressure situation. For me, I was very lucky in getting a very good break early playing with Stan Getz. And I would like to make this point, even though it's kind of a dismal one. Tom, you might not want me to say this, but I'm going to say it. As far as jazz education goes, there's tremendous advances happening now in the schools, and there's an enormous interest and enthusiasm among a lot of young people who are discovering jazz and improvisation music, and they love it, and they want to have it as a career. And by the hundreds and thousands, they're buying instruments and books and literature and enrolling in schools, which now do give degrees in jazz, which is amazing, which just happened in the last 5 or 10 years, as far as I know. And I don't know what these kids are going to do when they get out of school, because there are about, as far as I know, about 20 jazz gigs now, jazz gigs for heavy leaders, Art Blakey, Stan Getz, Miles When He Plays, Sonny Rollins, I mean, Hal Silver, and not too many more of what I just mentioned. Now, there are a lot of other gigs that are related to that, where now not everyone that goes to a school wants to be a jazz soloist in a virtuoso setting. There's plenty of room for big bands, but how many big bands are there out there making a living? It's very similar to what's going on in the classical world, and has gone on for years. There are millions of students enrolled in academic institutions like Juilliard or Manhattan School of Music, and they all have hopes of having concert careers. And we know that there's only room for three or four. It's much harder. Much harder. And the orchestra is trying to get into a major orchestra in the United States. It's easy to become president, you know what I'm saying? So it's very grim. What happens is there's a lot of teaching happening. But on the brighter side of it, excuse me, on the brighter side of it, I feel that even if these kids that come out of school and they want to have a career as a jazz musician, and if they can't, I still think it's incredible, because if nothing other than there'll be a more sophisticated and educated record buying public who can turn on thousands of people and an educated listener, you know, that to me, you know, we're building a giant audience. That's really the rational way of looking at jazz education now, which in the end will help the musicians. As far as survival goes, I'm also lucky to have gotten in on ECM Records when they first started. I did a trio record called Eon in 1974. I did some recording with Dave with Lookout Farm even before that. And I had a solo piano record released last year. ECM has had an amazing rise, and it's really a very hopeful signal to me, because it's an example of a total quality, no compromise record company producing records without the thought of cost, doing whatever the artist wants, presented in such a way as good as a major record company, and sometimes better. Quality pressings, amazing covers, like real laminated carbon in the covers. You know, you take the record out and it doesn't fall apart. And paying very good money. And all of a sudden, ECM became amazingly popular. I mean, the head of the company, Manfred Eicher, had no idea, didn't expect, and probably didn't even want it to be so big. Now, recently, they have distribution by Warner Brothers in the United States, which has a multi-million dollar machine for advertising and promotion. So it's kind of like a dream where you have quality music presented with rock and roll bread. It's amazing. And the truth is that because the company line sells well, I'm lucky enough to be included in that, and I get a check in the mail every 5 or 6 months for royalties. Now, that's really one of the only ways that I earn money. I mean, when you go out on the road, you don't make that much money, at least I don't, because most of it is eaten up with expenses and such like that. The way I make money is I get a check in the mail that way for royalties and publishing and stuff like that. That allows me a certain freedom in New York where I don't have to do certain jobs unless I want to. But this is only in the last 3 years. Up until 3 years ago, I was still having to do things, you know. So I take that as a real good sign. And also, ECM being the biggest of the small companies, there are a lot of other companies now that are enjoying popular, like Inner City and Black Lion and a whole bunch of small companies that are selling records, you know. It seems to be an interest in the underground now. Sometimes you have records that are reviewed and bought in preference to the bigger companies just because they're underground. It's kind of a reverse snobbishness that sometimes is a pain in the ass. But look, you have small artists that are able to work, you know. So I think that, again, is a cross-section of kind of work that you have to do in New York. As far as education goes, I taught privately for about 5 or 6 years. I derived a lot of income from that, rather than work in some kind of bars, you know. And I found that was very rewarding, but also amazingly draining, because at the level that I taught at, which was pretty advanced level, someone comes to a young guy, and it's his whole life. He wants to be a jazz musician. Basically, he wants to be you. And it gets very personal really quick, and he starts telling you about his old lady, and he wants to move out, and he doesn't have the money. And next thing you know, he's laying down on the couch, and you're a shrink. And I would always wonder, after a lesson, why I'd be so tired. The kid would walk out, you know what I'm saying? The kid would walk out, and he would be in the clouds, and I'd go pass out, you know? Yeah, right.
1,000% right.
So I gave up private teaching, and I said I got to put that information somewhere, because then I started getting this amazing guilt, like I have this information and I'm not giving it out, you know, am I hoarding it or what? So we got into writing books, and then we got into doing clinics, so you could like reach 300-400 people at one shot, you know. Now we're gonna, as a matter of fact, we're going to be doing 2 clinics on Monday. One at Tom School, ASU, and one at Mesa College, you know. That's the way I enjoy teaching them in large situations, you know. So.
Freddie, you have private students, and you also teach in a university. Do you have any reactions to
that? I agree with Richard. Really, I have to say that in all honesty. It's really draining, and I'm pretty sure that my private teaching is going to really get very limited. Very shortly. I overextended myself about 2 years ago when I accepted that situation at Rutgers. I thought I could do it and continue my playing and continue with everything that I was doing. If I had everything worked out like I thought I could do it, I found I couldn't do that. It just doesn't work. Students need attention. They do. They really need attention. The people are coming to you for something that they don't know anything about that you're supposed to be a professional in. And they will drain you. I mean, just like he said, the guys talk about moving out from his old lady and his mother is treating him wrong. I mean, just like he says, man, it's the honest to God truth. You find yourself standing there listening to a guy's life story. When he leaves, he's happy and you're about dead, you know. So I have to admit, too, also, I do enjoy it, Richard. I enjoy dealing with young people in teaching situations. The reason why I said limited, I'm going to just probably teach a few people. But I think I probably will be doing some teaching in some kind of capacity. In terms of the club situation, myself personally, I don't like clubs. I love to play in them, but I hate the club.
You don't like
Vanguard?
I
love playing the Vanguard. I like playing the Vanguard very much. You know, the Vanguard, and I found another place over at the Shakespeare Public Theater. That's the only 2 places in New York that I found myself that I'm really comfortable in.
I have to disagree.
You know, I haven't been to that place.
Yeah. I really enjoy McKell's.
Oh, right. I love McKell's.
I love McKell's. McKell's gives me a chance to really stretch out, because all walks of people come in McKell's. You have musicians, non-musicians, you have record lovers, you have musician lovers. You have every kind of person to come into McKell's. They come in there strictly for the music. No matter how much drinking, how much talking that they do, when you really got something to say, they are actually listening. They love what you're doing, and consequently, that's what we're all about, because without that, we are nothing. We are really nothing without you coming out to enjoy us or to listen to what we have to say. And with those applause, we can move mountains. We can move anything, anybody, any place, anywhere, in the world, with just plain old applause. Thank you. I happen to be very, very fortunate that, for me, clubs is a very, very big and vital thing for me. Now, I don't make any money in clubs, but I've been fortunate enough to make a few dollars on the other end. Make
How many?
Which end? I happen to be lucky enough to make some records.
Lucky.
Played on a few records. And I'm fortunate enough now to be able to produce a few. And it's worked out fine for me. Now, in the concerts, basically, is where musicians make money. That's about the only place that you really can make money unless you become the artist with artist royalties, if you get a hit record. Otherwise, you've got to go in the studio and play in the studio in order to survive. And out of, it's almost, I think it's about 60 million, 60,000 musicians in New York, in local 802, there's roughly about 1,000 who actually make records. And there's about 300 who make records every week. Well, that's not too high. So we are fortunate enough to say that for the guys that are up here, you helped make us what we are today. You gave us that chance and opportunity, whether you bought the records, whether you came to the concerts where we are, but you gave us the room to move around. And we are only trying to repay you. For instance, just coming here to Arcosanti is a treat for us, to give to you something that you have given to us. I love it. I enjoy it. And for me, it's going to be a pleasure to be the house drummer here at Arcosanti, along with Freddie Waits. He ain't getting paid for it either. But it's a pleasure for us to be here.
Well, wait a minute, Bob.
You volunteered.
But back about this club situation, though. He spoke about McKell's. I've worked in McKell's several times myself with my own group. And McKell's is located uptown Manhattan, 97th Street and Columbus Avenue. Now,
almost in Harlem.
Now, the idea of McKell's, the reason why I will work with McKell's, although I did say, and I do still say that I did not like clubs, the people that own the club, Mike and Pat.
Yeah, Mike and Pat.
Very nice people. Although, me, my preferences are, I like to play a club maybe for a week, but when I said I didn't want to play a club, I don't feel like going across country on a club tour anymore, Richard. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I don't think any of us really want to go.
I don't want to go out for New York.
Across country on a club tour,
which we've all done. Yeah. Leave New York and be in California 2 months later and 50 clubs later. You know, it's a whooping, man. You can't use that. What I like now is I like to do a club maybe once, you know, a week, and then do some concerts and some lecture demonstrations and some other things that I also enjoy, solo concerts and situations like that. Right now, I don't think a club is really could hire a solo drummer necessarily.
Well, it's basically,
that's another thing to deal
it still
with.
Comes down to dollars and cents.
You know,
is that we can't make money in clubs, but you have to get your thing off.
Well, I agree with David. The experience that you acquire in a club
right.
is very important. I have to admit, jazz has grown out of the club atmosphere itself. So the musician, the looseness that you acquire through those three or four sets a night, let's face it, if you're not professional and really up on your instrument, a concert can really do you down. You got to be ready. The club is a good thing to get together, to learn to pace yourself, to learn the things that you're going to do on that 45-minute concert. So I think it is an important factor in young jazz musicians to do, to play the club. Personally, I think I've just about had enough of every night-to-night club situations. You know, the concerts, the clinics, they're informative. Students are closer to you. They get a chance to really understand that you are definitely human, and you breathe and eat just like they do, and that they can't possibly do what you're doing. It's not something that's a rarity of that sort. And it gives me a better chance to be human myself. Sometimes a club atmosphere has a tendency to put you a little uptight.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, maybe finalize this. I think that the club situation, which was the predominant source of the music for long, most of the time, attributed to the short lifespan of a lot of jazz musicians. And I think it's directly related to that environment, psychologically and definitely physically. So we don't really want to do that because we've learned a little from them.
Go ahead. Don't you think that's it's a little bit like the actor that wants to be on the Broadway stage. He gets tired of making movies.
Yeah.
Yes. What I like the university for, again, I'm talking from my own little small world, is it's a selfish motive. I haven't had to play a note of bullshit in 15 years. Now, I may not play it as well as others, but the university situation is a dream world situation, and if it's used properly, and if we lay the right kind of music on the folks, it can be a bastion of our art. Nevertheless, I'm speaking personally, since we all diversified environments and lives, I just moved out of here, and I miss the hell out of playing in clubs. the staleness of a recital hall gets to you after a while. I want to get loaded.
I think we're talking about the main thing that seems to come out is that we all need diversification within our own musical lives. Nobody just wants to play all concerts. Nobody just wants to teach. Nobody just wants to play clubs, you know. I think the change is important. I think that's true for any artist, whether it's a painter or a dancer or even a critic doesn't want to review the same kind of records, right, Dan? I mean, you get tired of that stuff after a while, right? So the point is that when we go from one related field to another related field, it kind of gives you a different view of the situation. I mean, after I do three or four concerts, I do want to play in a club.
On the other hand, it's also a nice situation.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is unique to this music.
I can attest to that about Miles, working with Miles a year and a half to 2 years I worked with him. We played mostly concert tours, concentrated tours, of course, you know, Big Bird and all that, and giant halls. But we did play two clubs constantly, and that was Paul's Mill in Boston and the Keystone in San Francisco. And we would play three sets, and it was the best playing that I would hear Miles do or hear the band do, I have to say.
Well, I go along with the program with everybody there. When it came down to concerts, I was with Aretha Franklin. And the greatest thrill in the world was when we finished at 11 o'clock, the concert, half the band would be in her club that evening playing along with Aretha if somebody got lucky. If the club was large enough to be ringed up, she would end up sitting down playing the piano with the local guys around the town, which was a big thing for her and everybody else. But we all basically really feel the same when it comes down to variety, as one was said. But we know that we need clubs to get close to you. That's really about the only way that we can really get close to you, to talk with you, to have you 2 feet in front of us, to look us in the face, cuss us out, tell us if you like us, and if you don't play your song, you have a chance to say what you want to say that's on your mind. I mean, whether we accept it or not, that's something different. But you have the chance and the opportunity to make us get our thing off. And I think
That's basically what everything boils down to in the long run. We need you as well as you needing us to do our thing. And we end up doing our thing together.
Could I ask a question? I would like to know, just arbitrarily out there, what do you think about that situation? How do you like to sit down? What's your favorite spot to listen to music, concert, club, whatever?
Did everybody hear that?
He said he liked the club situation. He felt that he had a better relationship with the artist.
Say that again?
Just to get to some music.
Mm-hmm. Yes, dear. Because a lot of things are happening. The theater is becoming a big club for us. There are a lot of promoters buying theaters where they can actually bring in a name artist, can afford to pay him, make a profit, and let the people enjoy and get closer, almost as close as you are would be in a club situation, by being in the theater without being just in the big concert halls, but coming into the theater where the actual seats are very close as you would go to watch the movies. So we find now that we are doing a lot more theaters than we are concerts outdoors in Carnegie Hall and the big theaters in the cities, the major cities. So I think the theater is helping get the artists closer to the public.
Yeah, I just want to make one point. I think that we're forgetting one thing. When we talk about concerts versus clubs, we're talking about a wide diversification of music. When we say jazz, there's a lot of different kinds of music at this table. You know, like if we talk about bebop, I mean, I worked with Stan Getz for a year. And Stan hated concerts because he was brought up in the clubs. He felt really comfortable in the club. He could skate. He could go to the bar. He could come back while the rhythm section played. He could look around. You know, he felt real good in the club. And we do a concert, and he always played well, but he didn't feel as relaxed. And Miles even said once, I read someplace in an interview, he says, how are you going to feel relaxed at a jazz concert? You know, a jazz concert. But then I'm a pianist, and like last night, a duet we played with together here, me and Dave, I really need quiet for me to get over. I can get over in a noisy club, but if it's quiet, it gives me a blank canvas. It gives me a range of dynamics that are not available in most clubs because the competition with waitresses trying to hustle drinks, with people eating food. If you're sitting down and you have a drink in front of you, it's really weird not to talk to somebody. So you're going to talk. If two people talk, four people talk, that's it. They blow your tune. It's out. So for the kind of music that I like to play, concerts are better. But then again, I worked with Dave in February in a quintet situation with Randy Brecker and Al Foster in the Village of Vanguard. We played for a weekend. It was magic because people come to the Vanguard and be quiet because it's been there for 40 years. So they come and they're quiet, that's respect. But, and Bernard, Mikkels is a whole other situation. Mikkels is a party. Mikkels is not, you know, that music, you know what I'm saying? You go there to have a party.
You really do.
You know what I'm saying?
You're 100% right.
So I think that we gotta really,
even though it is a club, it's a club, still a club.
It is
no matter how we look at it.
Right.
But it's a club where people basically come out to listen to the music. They really do come out to listen. So, well, a lot of people come out to be seen.
Okay, I agree about that. We'll be talking about with McKell's. But I'm just really saying, I have to go with Richie some of that ways, man. It's a party. I mean, those people be so loud sometimes in there that, I mean, you can hear more people than you can hear music. And I'm talking about the band is wide open.
But the thing with me...
And you hear a dude downstairs.
Man,
it's part of the music, though. I tell you the truth, I think the party is part of that music.
Yes, it is.
My life for me.
Definitely.
The people are not talking and drinking and hanging. You don't want to play. You don't want to play in a dead, quiet hall.
Well, I agree with you. But the biggest thing for me is that half the time, I do not hear the people. When I get involved with the guys in the band, and with that band, when we're on stage, sure, I see the people. But I really don't hear them because I concentrate and put my concentration and my thoughts into the music. And once we get off, if the band gets off on each other, then we've done what's necessary to get our thing off to the people, because then the people begin to come and get into you. But as long as we are into ourselves and we play, I mean, we really play and kick asses, they appreciate it and they show it. And that happens to be a big thing. And I think that basically we have to do that when we're on concerts for the big halls.
You
we have to get into ourselves before we have to. We cannot worry about what is out there.
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, we love you. We love you. But we definitely have to get into ourselves in order for you to get into us, because we know that you are looking and watching and waiting for us to make a mistake. So you can talk about us, and I can't blame you, because I go myself to see the same thing.
Well, man, that's funny, but I go along with that, because a band that plays concerts a lot, like when we work opposite, for instance, we worked opposite John McLaughlin, was that Massachusetts? I remember that was a band that only did concerts from the very beginning almost, because of the sounds of it. And those guys, they would be concerts, they would stage 10,000 people like it was a club. You see, so it really is relative, because if you play concerts all the time, I'm sure the retail, after a while, it's 10,000, 20,000, 10, 100. It's still like, you're gonna get into that kind of thing. It kind of has to do with the artist. But really, in jazz, I think particularly in jazz, in the kind of music, you know, that, for instance, what Rich is talking about, when I play, it's, the situations are vastly different. I mean, the duet that we played last night, we made a set that had to do with playing here for you in this environment, and maybe a couple hundred people, and that we knew would be pretty good attention, people who wanted to hear the music. Now, we go on Sunday, and we're going on with Stephen Stills or whoever, and we're going on, and, well, I mean, you know, but the point is that we're going to have like 8,000 to 9,000 people by that time, maybe by the end. And, I mean, the majority of people who've heard of Richie or myself or several of us as jazz artists is going to be very small. And I think that's a great thing that Bruce, the coordinator, did to mix it up like that. I think that's great for the audience. It's great for the musicians. But, of course, now that puts on, for instance, in our set, we're going to have a different kind of set because of, well, the distance and the amount of people and so forth. But just because the attention span will probably be different based on the experience of such a kind of event.
But so, we're going to be good.
Yeah.
That's it.
I hope so.
Can't help but be good.
Let me ask you, gentlemen. I've heard this argument. I've heard some, they'll remain nameless, but I've heard some musicians say they prefer the recording studio because everything is perfect there. What's your reaction to
you
that?
You don't want it always perfect. You don't want perfect. You want some
say.
Resistance.
No.
I'm saying you want resistance sometimes.
We need resistance.
I mean,
I never thought it was perfect. But
the pearl comes from an abrasion on the middle of the oyster. Do you know what I'm saying? There's no pearl without that sand in there, you know? So and a diamond comes from pressure. It's corny. But I particularly like pressure situations because it wakes me up. Because I've been playing the piano since I'm about 5 years old, and I've played most of the kind of places that you can play, and I tell you the truth, I go to sleep unless there's something on it. You know, I'm not saying it's nice to play when you're sick or your leg is broken, although that's happened plenty of times. I was in India
with Dave, and I got a little amoeba, you know? And we played a lot of concerts, and there were a lot of bass solos instead of piano solos. There was a lot of, like, quick exits, you know what I'm saying? So, and that was, that. At the time, I didn't like it, but it taught me something, you know? The show must go on. Really, some vaudeville, you know? It's talking about vaudeville. So I particularly do not like perfect situations. You know, right. I like it when you get out on the, you know, there's the magnificent Steinway and there's a great sound system and there's a drunken lady in the front that's cursing and asking you to play a song, you know?
It makes it special.
It puts a one-time thing on it, you know? I don't like that plastic environment, you know? I could never be a studio musician. I would be shot.
Yeah, I agree. That situation is perfect. I don't think the studio is perfect, first of all.
No, a lot of people call it perfect, but it really isn't.
It's controlled, is what it is.
Controlled, contrived, whatever, you know. But myself, I think the challenge of an audience is interesting. The surprises that you can get out of an audience. You never know what an audience is going to like. As many people there are out there, as many different preferences of what they would like to hear. And the artist is really up on the spot to please or open those people up to something new or whatever. The surprise excites me. I like that myself. I can sometimes even go to the point of creating surprise myself, you know.
Well, I think that... Yeah, go ahead.
I love it.
We love it. That's really the thing for us.
After a solo,
really.
After a particular lick.
When we've done a solo and you like the solo, applaud. No matter, even if you do it by yourself, applaud. Because we know that you are into us. You are into what is happening, what is going on. We need it. Sure, we understand that when you get to the end, you'll give a big, big applaud. But that one in the middle is another thing. Have mercy.
Oh. Any other questions? We'll take the last 10 minutes of this for questions.
Go ahead.
Going into... Yes, we feel the pressure from the producer, the man who's putting out the money. Our problem is that when we get into those kind of situations, and everybody up here, unless you are the man that's in charge, we have to go along with the program. We are actually told, basically, what they want. Now, the artist, half the time, really don't have anything to say. If the producer happens to be a Herb Albert. You know, I mean, let's face it. You actually have gone across, and it becomes, to them, a commercialized record that they want to program you. It's like anything else. You end up getting programmed after a certain period of time, where they feel as though the masses of what they'll be able to sell to make money. Now, he's in the business to make money. So we have to go along with what the masses, not what individuals are basically going to like. So we are basically told what we have to play. Now, because we are fortunate enough to be versatile players, everybody up here, we still get a chance to put a little bit of us in it. Like for me, it's a great thing because I know that I can turn myself off. I can, you know, turn on and turn off just like you turn the record player on and off. When I'm called to do a job, and it basically means to keep my mouth shut. Because if it came down to what I had to do, if I go out to do a job, if I don't like it, and at one time, I said for almost 10 years, I was blacklisted and blackballed from the music industry. Because I had a big mouth. But everything I seem to say worked. So long as I kept making things work and kept things happening, people would call me. But the minute that something it looked like it wasn't going to happen, and they didn't sell any records, and they didn't do this, and they didn't do that, and didn't make any money, well, don't call Purdy because he talks too damn much. But I was fortunate enough that the things that I said worked. I tried to be as creative as possible without getting in the way and affecting the producer and making the producer look small. But in the beginning, I was wrong. I was just loud. I just had a big mouth, and I wanted to say what I had to say, whether the guy called me back or not. I didn't care. But now I've learned how to control it. I've learned how to shut up once in a while.
Oh, yeah? I was on the WV once. Well, actually, this is for Aaron Bernard's case. I mean, he happens to be a great catalyst. And I did a date with Peter Harris. It was his record. Peter had him just, you know, it was like you could tell why Bernard was there. It was to catalyze the rhythm section and get the feeling happening and so forth. And that's what he's known for, and that's what he does. I think that the situation of compromise that you're referring to, whether it be God or Babu or anybody, first of all, is very personal to each artist. You'd have to ask each artist if he feels he's compromising, first of all.
Right.
Second of all, certain artists are in a, you know, have set themselves and have done that as strongly as the kind of artists who set themselves the opposite way, talking about being a very aesthetic, you know, very purist kind of approach. I mean, there are guys who have pursued that career as strongly as somebody who's pursuing standing on their head or playing four instruments with one hand, or, you know, in other words, the range of characteristics that makes you public, makes you seen, and makes you noticeable. But I think that it really comes down to each artist, and actually you as listeners, you know, it's up to you to kind of formulate an opinion based on when you hear a man's music and you see such a great change in maybe a record or two. I guess it's obvious to think that there was pressure put on, but you cannot always be sure of that. I know I had that situation, one of my records that I did, and got a lot of flack for that. From critics and from people who knew me, saying, "What are you doing? Sell out and all this garbage," you know. And actually, I really wanted to do that, and I had that about my mind for years. And you know, when I would talk to somebody about it, I could trace the music revolution, I'd give reasons for it, and so forth. But the point is that I think that you as listeners should be, you know, in general, the critics and listeners are kind of rough on musicians who make something a little different than what they're known for. And I think that you all should lighten up sometimes and let the artist have the freedom for a while, because then he can probably maneuver in a different way, especially since an artist's career is not based on one or two or three records. Hopefully it's based on a 30, 40-year output. And then you look at a man's output and you say, this is what he's done. And hopefully it covers a lot of areas. And to me, that's a kind of a goal.
Thank you. That's very, very good. Yes, sir. Do you feel as though that's wrong?
I don't want to use poor chick as an example.
He's not poor.
He's a great musician. I think that what's happening is that there has been a move in the last years towards more composed music. It just happens to be happening in jazz or whatever you want to call it. And that's kind of one of the fusions that we're talking about. That the area of written music and of playing a part at a certain time on the record, or at least in the music, and maybe having 16 bars improvised, and then a whole page of written music or a unison line or something like that has become, it's actually, it's what now I wouldn't call it an innovation, but it's one of the significant characteristics of the music of the 70s. I would say that. And I would say that somebody like Chick or John McLaughlin's group, first group, were some of the people who made that happen like that. And I think it's a very valid form of, you know, I didn't call it improvisation, but I think it has a place in the music. Obviously, you don't want to miss the flavor of improvisation. Now, with Chick, for instance, in this tour that I did, there was quite a lot written out, but there was always at least one or two stretched out solos. Now, they were 20-minute solos. I'm not saying that they were the main event of the evening, but there was a pretty good balance, at least in his case, of written and improvised music. In the case of a guy like that, if he improvises so great, I mean, you know, he can improvise, he can say as much in 8 bars as some people can say in 18 minutes, and you're not really going to miss it. It's the guys that don't improvise that well to your ear as a listener that you think that they might think it's a little too much composition, really, because it's the quality of improvisation is really high. It won't bother you that it may not take up that much time.
Agree. And also, I think also that on you, the public, as opposed to when something is heard, 5 or 6 new kinds of arrangements, don't feel that that's the way any particular interview is going, that that's changing the whole style of what you call jazz, because you've heard several arranged compositions. I think Dave is absolutely right. Anybody deserves the right to try things. I think Train and everybody was experimental in things that they did. And things that you're talking about now are experimental things. Chick did it, and other people. I've been involved in some things of that sort also. But that's not the trend of the music is going in that direction. It's just another thing to do. And I think it should be accepted that way. It's not that anything is going to take over anything. It's just something else to do with the music. I mean, it has a large thing to draw from. We draw from so many areas, so many different things, different ways to approach this music. That's just another way.
With some jazz musicians today, I mean, especially the ones who have crossed over into a larger audience, whatever you want to call it, they use jazz as a texture rather than the basis of the music. They use Latin music as a texture. They use composition as a texture. They use they use the elements of music to put together a style rather than just get up there and play All Things You Are for an hour and a half, which is totally valid if you can sustain it. You know, there are very few that can. You know, I think that that's what, again, I talked about the era of synthesis. Jazz has been around for 75 years now, so that the fact is that there are a lot of subsections of it. There are a lot of titles to it, the different kinds of jazz, you know. And there are some men now that are really interested in just being jazz-based artists and not totally giving to that one ear, you know. I mean, even someone like Herbie, who has done everything possible and is like, always is going back and forth. He's just a creative musician, you know. He uses jazz. He uses funk. He uses Latin music. He'll use Hollywood strings. He doesn't care. He'll use it all, you know. Now, I just want to say something about this because I feel from the audience, and I used to feel this way too. When you're listening to a lot of heavy music, when you're learning, especially if you want to be a musician, you listen to the masters, you listen to Train, and you listen to Miles and Bird, and you come up on that heaviness, that weight, that depth, that soul-searching thing that you want. And then you hear your favorite musicians, maybe they move to the West Coast, and they suddenly put together a different kind of music, more commercial music, more accessible, there's more hooks in it, there's definite musical things that you can say. The first reaction is, why did he do that? I mean, why did he do that? What that feeling is, you are outraged. You are personally upset at what your expectations are of that artist. You want him to continue what he was doing. That's very weird when you think about it. Because it's up to him to lay down what he wants to do. Now, everyone has their own expectations, but if they're not met, that doesn't mean that he's wrong. It means that you were surprised. There are some people that base their whole careers on surprising people. Do you know what I'm saying? So you have to take that with a lot of salt. You know, you have to give, like Dave was saying, you have to give them a lot of rope. There are some obvious concessions that are disgusting. And that, I mean, we can talk about it. I mean, Freddie Hubbard was really handled badly. And his records were really like, they destroyed him, you know? And the horrible thing is that he sold 250,000 records. A smart producer. They put Freddie in a mold. He's a genius trumpet player. Freddie went public in millions of interviews saying that he was unhappy, he was unhappy, he was unhappy. Finally, his last record is a really good, to me, jazz record. It's a similar kind of record that he used to do on CTI, even Blue Note. You know, so like there's a situation where a major artist went through a cycle and changed. Also, Herbie came back and changed Chick, and Herbie did a duet tour. You know, there's a lot of things going on. So what I'm just saying is don't have expectations for the artist. And if you're outraged, check yourself out.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. You mean, you think we're like you?
I hope so.
Oh, man, don't you dare. Don't be putting me in my heart. My goodness gracious.
Like this guy?
Why? Oh, psychological. Oh, that's okay. Oh, that's all right.
I don't think God has such long sideburns, Bernard.
Huh? Say that again. Let who, me? Oh, well, say it again. You play drums, no wonder. I knew you were looking at me for a reason. Go ahead. You're a rock and roller. I'm a rock and roller, did you know? Yeah, go ahead. One of the best things in the world and one of the best examples is right here. I was called a rock and roller. I knew nothing far as public was concerned. I knew nothing but rock and roll. Why couldn't I be called a drummer? That's all I wanted. I didn't want to, I would even accept not even being called a musician. Just call me a drummer. Why do I have to be a rock and roll? I'm a rock and roll, oh yeah, Cole Purdy, he's a rock and roll drummer. Well, I made a lot of money, but the point was, I wanted was to be called a drummer. Because when I started out playing, I was playing with the big band at the age of 10. Yes, playing the big band, having a ball, having a good time. Didn't know what the hell I was doing, but I was having a good time. And as things moving on, I learned how to play. As you say, on-the-spot training. You know, I learned how to play with other people as time went on. I mean, I got to certain points where it didn't matter. It still doesn't to me today. It doesn't matter who I play for. Now, I had a ball playing Jeff Beck. I had a ball playing Gato Barbieri. I had an even bigger ball playing with Dave. It's wonderful. We're going to have a good time playing with Freddie. Two drummers play, we love it. We're not in competition with one another. I'm prettier than he is, so I don't have to worry. I'm in good shape.
On that happy note, I think we will conclude. I want to thank all the panelists, but also I think what was raised here at the end is very important. We all tend to over-label and over-define things, and jazz, which in some ways is in itself a label, but jazz is a music that is very diversified and very broad, so resist the temptation to try to pigeonhole it and define it too narrowly, and give the artist room to search and find and discover and help you discover things. Jazz is a music of great generosity of spirit, and I think that our panelists have shown you some reasons why that is so. Stay tuned to this channel, because very shortly we will have for you Anthony Braxton talking to you and with you about his music. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you.
Thank you!